Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast. Thanks very much for downloading us. You can always download the A segment, the news of the week, and what it means to you, all the way back to number one. This is number 934B, the news of the week, and I talked about elk and deer, as well as why high-fat diets may not be what your colon wants, and why it may be bad to sleep with wet hair on that, what to do about those things, and how you can do better, and why we're having a tough time getting people to quit smoking, and why it's much tougher now than it was just 3 years ago. But today we have a great interview for you. This is the B segment, and Jonathan Haas, H-A-A-S, I've got to ask him if he's any relation to the golfer, but Jonathan Haas is a prostate cancer treating oncologist. He's really a radiation oncologist. He's chair of the department at NYU Winthrop. You can go there, NYU Winthrop, W-I-N-T-H-R-O-P, no periods or apostrophes in before it, but after the Winthrop, put .org, NYUWinthrop.org, and you can get him, or 1-844-WINTHROP, I think he said. No, actually, it's 1-866-WINTHROP, and ask for Jonathan Haas if you want. I'll give you that again at the end so you can listen to his stories about the cyber knife. By the way, you'll want to download 933B if you haven't already listened to it. Steve Masley talked about the Breader Brain Solution, his book by that title, but also talked about why you should get a speed of processing assessment every year, just as you would getting a, if you will, a lipid profile every year, just as you would get your influenza shot every year. It's one of the things you can follow to assess how your brain is doing, and you can even reverse and see how much you're reversing it. And that's one of the great things preventing, I love this, it's actually preventing cognitive dysfunction, preventing dementia by improving your speed of processing. And of course, we talked with him about how to do that. In the meantime, let's get on with prostate cancer and Jonathan Haas. Jonathan, are you related to the golfer by the same last name?
I wish, but I can say honestly that I'm not. I wish I had his game and I wish I had his skills. I do play a little bit, but nothing like that.
So he is a wonderful golfer. For those of you who don't know Mr. Haas as the golfer, he's just a huge, incredible golfer, not huge in size, but huge in personality, huge in quality. He won the U.S. Open as his first tournament, which is amazing. Then he got injured, and he went and said, what is needed where he lives, which is, I think, in northeast Arkansas and or in Alabama someplace. And he said, we need a distributorship for, if you will, CAT, the equipment maker, and has done a very successful business in that. He innovated in that way. Just like Jonathan Haas has in as chair of radiation oncology at NYU Winthrop. I should go over his history because it is so illustrious, but I just will say that he's been to a number of organizations that my son also, as a pediatric endocrinologist, was at, different area fields. He was at WashU in St. Louis and then at the University of Pennsylvania, two of the outstanding places in the world. And so now you're at another place, NYU Winthrop, and you apparently have a cyber knife. First, let's talk about prostate cancer. How common is it?
Sure. I mean, it's one of the most common diseases that we see in oncology. You know, over 160,000 men are diagnosed yearly with it. Numbers of it's interesting. It's controversial, but you know, the numbers of newly diagnosed cases have gone down. And the reason for that, as you may know, is that the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force several years ago passed guidelines questioning the routine use of PSA. Those of us who are experts in the field strongly disagreed with that. You know, but on the panel, there were no medical oncologists, there were no radiation oncologists, and there were no urologists. So those of us in the specialty kind of strongly disagreed. So we've actually seen the number of cases go down, but those that are picked up are unfortunately at a later stage now, and we actually just submitted an abstract to ASTRO, which is our biggest meeting of the year, which will be in Chicago, and we're seeing a phenomenon of stage migration, where you're seeing fewer cases being picked up, but those that are more aggressive. So I still encourage men to speak to their internist to get a PSA. But it is one of the most common diseases still that we see in the United States. When caught early, it's also one of the most treatable and curable. So to your listeners out there, if you're over 50, at least have a strong discussion with your primary care physician about getting a PSA. I strongly believe in it.
And so one of the important things you said now that we should talk to people about is they have to talk to their, whoever their primary care physician is, or if they're seeing a specialist, they have to ask for or at least agree to get a PSA and have a discussion about the consequences and what they do with it if they're going to get diagnosed, most likely if they're going to get diagnosed early. That is, the PSA can't be done routinely anymore by us for people with most insurance plans, and certainly in the Medicare age, we're stopped from doing it as a routine. Even in executive health, we have to ask the person to do it and then add it on as a test after they've had their blood drawn rather than select it beforehand. Kind of weird. And so this
right,
is kind
so
of...
Issue,
go ahead.
Yeah, it makes no sense because a PSA is the most or one of the most effective screening tools that we have in all of oncology. And you know, the issue isn't who should be screened. The issue is who should be treated. You know, I accept the premise that many cases of men with prostate cancer don't need treatment. And one of the programs that we've established here at NYU Winthrop is we take a holistic approach to oncology, meaning, you know, we include the patient in the decision-making process. So if you have a Gleason score 6, which is a very non-aggressive cancer, and a PSA less than 10, you're perfectly appropriate for watching it. But the issue isn't, in my opinion, who should be screened, it's who should be treated. And if we put our head in the sand and ignore what, in my opinion, is one of the most valuable screening tools in all of oncology, we're going to be back in the 1970s and 1980s and picking up much fewer cases of prostate cancer, but those that come in are now metastatic, they have hematuria, they're bleeding, and they're not curable. So you actually, I think, have been visionary with you, the owner's manual, telling your readers and listeners, of which I'm one, to take ownership of your everything, your health, your treatment. When you go to the doctor, there's some ownership of the patient to have a discussion of what should be done, and we are the experts. But I like when a patient's done their homework and they've read about the different treatments for prostate cancer. They challenge me about surgery, about watchful waiting, about CyberKnife, which we can talk about, obviously, and the different treatments that are out there. So in this day and age, in the internet day and age, where you know, you can pull up knowledge, you know, with a few button clicks, I think it's on the patient to kind of do their homework before they meet with their doctors.
Let's talk about the Gleason score. You mentioned it and other things. So let's say you do get a PSA or a digital rectal exam that is suspicious, meaning your PSA has increased too fast or it's at a high enough level that you want to go and do the next step. What is the next step? And we can talk about lifestyle as well. Everyone should be doing healthy lifestyle. And if it takes
sure.
this to do it, that's fine. But I wish it didn't. You should do it. But let's go right to medical, both diagnoses and treatments. What's the next step in diagnosing it or treating it?
So assuming that you have an elevated PSA, and PSA in and of itself can be done several ways. So the old historic way was to just get a PSA and you get a number. You know, anything, you know, 10 years ago over a 4 was considered abnormal. what we do now is there's different types of PSA. So you can get a PSA that's fractionated where you get a free PSA. So you may have a PSA that's 3.9, which may not sound abnormal, but your free PSA is low, and that's worrisome. So if you had a free PSA less than 20%, that would be worrisome, as opposed to a gentleman who has a PSA of 4.5, which is higher, but his free PSA is 30%. So, you know, when you get a PSA, it's important to see what the free PSA is. The other PSA that's out there is something called a 4K PSA, where the PSA is done, but they can break it up and look at what the risk of you having a cancer would be if you were to have a biopsy. But let's take it to the next. Let's assume that you have an abnormal PSA, you know, however that's interpreted. The next step would be for you to go to a urologist. They specialize in prostate cancer, men's health. They would usually do either a biopsy, or some of the urologists would get an MRI scan first to see if there's any suspicious lesions within that MRI scan.
Now, an MRI encompasses the whole body. Is there one that just focuses on the pelvis? How long does the MRI take? And why are we getting MRIs now? What does the MRI offer, for example, over
there? So that's a great question. So you can get a dedicated pelvic or prostate-only MRI scan. And what you're looking for is if you know, women that have breast cancer or have a mammogram, they give a score to it, a BI-RADS score. So now they have something called a PI-RADS score, you know, P for prostate, where within the MRI scan they can see if someone has an elevated lesion, are there abnormal areas within the MRI scan that look suspicious for cancer. If there are, the urologist has the ability to do something called a fusion biopsy, where they can fuse the images from the MRI scan into their ultrasound unit and then direct the biopsy needle at the suspicious area. So it's a more sensitive way to do a biopsy. Not that it's wrong to do a general biopsy, but this is kind of a more elegant way. And if a urologist has a suspicion that there's cancer, to do what's called a targeted or a fusion biopsy. Once the biopsy's done,
so just to let people know, how recent is this?
Fusion biopsies have been around for, you know, probably 5 years. I'm not a urologist, but it's been around for years. Not every urologist does it.
So the point I want to make is this is really in the last, if you said my dad had this in 1992, these are really differences in treatment in the last five
Absolutely.
Or 10 years. So go ahead.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, this is great, and again, I'm really flattered to be on. But so let's assume that the biopsy is done, and just to answer your question about what are the steps. So when the biopsy is positive, the cells go to a pathology doctor. A pathologist is a doctor that looks under the microscope and assigns what's called a Gleason score, which indicates how aggressive a cancer is. And the Gleason score is scored from 6 to 10. The least aggressive number is a 6. The most aggressive number is a 10.
And what does it mean? In other words, go ahead. What does the Gleason mean? I mean, in other words, how do you get a Gleason 10 versus a Gleason 6?
Yeah, so what they do is they actually give two numbers. The pathologist looks under the microscope, and they give the first number is what's called the major histology. So what do most of the cancer cells look like? And the second number is called the minor histology. So what do the rest of the cancer cells look like? So let's say, for example, you have a Gleason 7, and that could be either a 3+4 or a 4+3. So let's say you're a 3+4. So what the pathologist is saying, that under the microscope, most of the cells don't look that aggressive, but the remainder look more aggressive, you know, how active they are with growth rate, things like that. If you're a Gleason score 4+3, which is also a Gleason score 7, that means most of the cells are more aggressive and the minority are less aggressive. So we actually stratify the cancer by low risk, which means a Gleason score 6 and a PSA less than 10, intermediate risk, which means either a Gleason score 7 or a PSA between 10 and 20, or what we call high risk, which is either a Gleason score above 7 or a PSA above 20. And that has implications
into how
we recommend our treatment options.
Come back. So a Gleason 8, what would cause a prostate biopsy to be scored a Gleason 8?
So they may see the cells just look more undifferentiated. So when they look at the cells, if it looks like a normal prostate cell, they're round, they're clear, the more anaplastic or irregular that the cells look. And there's some subjectivity to it by the urologist, but they have criteria. You know, are the cells irregular? Do they see mitoses, you know, cells dividing? So the more aggressive the cell is, the more it gets upstaged from a 3 to a 4 to a 5 on that subgroup. So a Gleason score 8 or above means more of the cells are looking much less normal than they should.
And the other part of it, they look much less normal, and what else? So you say there are two parts to the score.
It's really the architecture. It's really, you know, again, I'm not a pathologist. I'm a radiation oncologist. But again, it's really how they look under the microscope. And they usually have two urologists to kind of confirm the same. You know, they'll say there was double-checked by a second urologist. And we actually have our policy that we double-check the outside pathology done here just to give it a make sure that we're in agreement.
And I think people should know how important that is and how unusual it is. The reason you want that done is 33% of the time, you say, well, pathology, it's got to be right, right, wrong. No, 33% of the time, it gets changed with second opinions. So having second opinion is incredibly important to make sure you get the right diagnosis. If you're going to do something more than 3 days, I say, if you're taking an antibiotic more than 3 days, you ought to get a second opinion. Same thing should happen if you're getting a surgical procedure. Please get it done. Get someone to look at it again.
I agree.
Now let's go back to when would one consider a CyberKnife versus a robotic robotic surgery, cold knife, I guess you'd call it, versus getting seeds or other forms of radiation. In other words, you're a radiation expert. What are the treatments in radiation other than surgery and watchful waiting for the low grade?
So there's several radiation treatments, and I'm first in most of them. So what CyberKnife is, which is one of the things that I specialize in, so radiation is typically delivered by something called a linear accelerator. It's a radiation machine that generates high energy radiation particles, which can be targeted. The way that we historically gave radiation is with something called IMRT or IGRT, which stands for intensity modulated radiation or image guided radiation, which is usually about a 6 to 9 week course of radiation. It's every day, Monday through Friday, not weekends. Treatment takes about 5 or 10 minutes a day, and it's a good treatment. The problem is with those types of machines, you can't compensate for the movement of the prostate in real time. So as a patient's laying on the table, they're going to breathe, they're going to move, and the prostate's going to move. So in order to compensate for that uncertainty of movement, you have to expand the margin or the area around the prostate so that you don't miss. What CyberKnife is, and we've been doing it now at NYU Winthrop for 14 years, it's a regular radiation machine or a linear accelerator that's been miniaturized and placed on a robotic arm. So the advantage of it is it's intelligent. It can actually track the movement of the prostate with the accuracy of less than a millimeter, which I tell my patients is the diameter of a piece of hair. So instead of doing a big 10 to 20 millimeter margin on the prostate with other forms of radiation, we do a 3 to 5 millimeter margin. So we're radiating less of the bladder, which sits on top of the prostate, less of the rectum, which sits behind the prostate, and we're now able to do the radiation in 5 days as opposed to 9 weeks, and you don't have to have surgery. The other treatment, which you mentioned, is something called prostate seeds or the radioactive seed implant. It's an older procedure. I used to do it. I used to teach it. I happen to love doing it. It requires that we go to the operating room. We put in anywhere from 30 to 100 radioactive seeds. It takes about an hour to do so. The problem with the seeds is, number one, you have to go to the operating room, but number two is you're going to be radioactive for up to 6 months or 3 to 6 months, so you can't be around any pregnant women or any children under 18. So that's a potential downside of the seeds. The nice thing about prostate cancer is that most radiation treatments, regardless of what a patient chooses, is going to work. You know, it's a very, very curable disease.
Now, let's talk about that. What are the difference in a radical nerve-sparing robotic prostatectomy versus a CyberKnife? So CyberKnife isn't cutting it out, it's irradiating it with a sensitive device that you say can aim within a hair's breadth, of getting of the tumor as judged by imaging.
That's correct. So I think the big fork in the road, you know, so I think the big fork in the road for most patients, you know, healthy patients, is surgery versus radiation. I don't think surgery is better than radiation. I don't think radiation is better than surgery. To be perfectly fair, I think they're equivalent. So some people just want to know that their prostate's in a garbage can somewhere. If that were the case, I would tell you to have a prostatectomy. Some people never want to step foot in an operating room because it is a real procedure. If that were the case, I would tell you to have radiation. For this particular disease, I personally think CyberKnife, or what we call SBRT, stereotactic body radiation therapy, is one of the best treatments out there for prostate cancer. If I have a treatment that's more accurate, that radiates less of the normal anatomy. And what I tell my patients is that even though the 5 days as opposed to 9 weeks sounds great, that, in my opinion, is not a reason to do it. You know, 5 years from now, patients not going to care whether they did it in 5 days or 45 days. The better reason to do it, in my opinion, is that you're giving a better dose of radiation to the cancer and less radiation to the normal surrounding anatomy. The 5 days is just the icing on the cake.
We've been talking with Dr. Jonathan A. Haas, H-A-A-S, Chairman of the Department of Radiation Oncology, which is treatment of tumors with radiation at NYU Winthrop Hospital on Long Island. It's nyuwinthrop.org is how you get, or 1-866-WINTHROP, WINTHROP, and then ask for Dr. Haas if you want to talk to him or you want even a second opinion about your prostate cancer. I'm sure he would be happy to, one, arrange if or talk to you specifically about it if the diagnosis is secure already. So that's 1-866-WINTHROP or nyuwinthrop.org. And last name is H-A-A-S for golfers. He's one of the great, it is the same name as one of the great golfers of all time. So the decision point of you've come to the point and you're either going to have surgery or radiation oncology, and you say the results are pretty similar, but there is something less with radiation therapy, and that is the incontinence, isn't it? And that is loss of urine or feces that you can't control, which I guess means what percent have to wear a diaper afterwards. Is that
right?
At least my understanding is that's a difference.
Right. So incontinence is a surgical side effect, which means that you leak. That almost never happens with radiation. With radiation, there's a very small risk of the opposite side effect, which is what we call urinary retention, or the urine getting stuck. That's unlikely, but that's about a 2% risk. So, you know, the different procedures have kind of opposite side effects. Surgery has a low risk, but the potential risk of incontinence, which means leakage, radiation has the very low risk of what we call retention or the urine getting stuck, both of which are treatable.
And is there anything else we should cover on the CyberKnife? So the CyberKnife has been used for a long period of time in brain tumors. It was being used back when I was in training. I would guess in 1974 or 5. It must have been invented soon after that because it was being used for brain tumors at UC San Francisco,
right?
Probably by 1980.
It was invented by a neurosurgeon named John Adler, who I'm friendly with, who's from Stanford. But you're right, it was invented in the Northern California area. CyberKnife for prostate cancer has been around for many, many years. So the first prostate cancer patient was treated in 2003. We started our program at NYU Winthrop in 2005, so this is now our 14th year. We are the largest CyberKnife prostate practice in the country. We're one of the reference sites. So when people from literally around the world want to learn CyberKnife, they come to us, or we lecture, you know, around the world. I was in Singapore last month. I'm going to San Diego next month, which I'm excited about. And NCCN guidelines, which is the government, and ASTRO, which is our governing body, both list SBRT, which is what CyberKnife is, stereotactic body radiation therapy, as a standard treatment option for low and intermediate risk disease, meaning the Gleason score 6s and the 7s. And our societies are now taking the point of view that this should actually be considered the new standard of care, because if you have a treatment that's more accurate, that radiates less of the normal anatomy, plus it's more convenient for the patient, on every level it's a winner.
So this whole interview has been a winner. We've been talking with Dr. Haas, Jonathan, J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N-A, Haas, H-A-A-S, Chairman of the Department of Radiation Oncology at NYU Winthrop on Long Island, nyuwinthrop.org, or 1-866-WINTHROP, I guess is how you get in touch with him. Obviously, a wealth of knowledge and skill in the cyberknife for prostate cancer. And I can tell you, were I to need a second opinion, we have great people here at Cleveland Clinic, but were I to need a second opinion, there is no doubt that Jonathan Haas would be on my list of people to definitely see. But thank God I don't have prostate cancer. One of the ways you can avoid that and lower your risk is, in fact, doing healthy things, doing the right amount of physical activity, 10,000 steps a day, weightlifting twice a week, doing 3 times of cardio, jumping 40 times a day, eating food that loves you back and you love it, obviously, managing stress, avoiding toxins. So those big 4 and getting the right amount of sleep, if you want to add the 5th, is, in fact, things that we advocate for the lifestyle treatment of low, Gleason score 6 or less, if you will, prostate cancer. But CyberKnife sounds very advantageous to me. Thanks very much, Dr. Haas. Ben, thank you for great engineering. Ben, thank you for great engineering, as usual. But especially thank you, the listeners, your 51,000 of you who download us weekly. That's what motivates us to continue to give you great interviews like Dr. Haas just gave us. Hope you download the A segment, the news of the week. We're trying to make them shorter, 10 to 12 minutes, and with all of the latest takes for you. And we'll be back next week with 935B. By the way, 933B was Dr. Stephen Masley. 932, Scott Lutofsky talking about the chemotherapy treatment of brain tumors and enhancement with antioxidants or supplements. Stephen Masley talking about the Better Brain Solution. And the A's each week are the latest news of the week and what it means to you. Thanks again for downloading us.